Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of like clinical precision.
Oh, sure.
You break your arm, the x-ray shows this jagged white line, and the doctor just points at it and says, there it is.
Right. It's a very comforting way to view the world. I mean, we
Yeah.
really crave that kind of visible binary categorization in almost everything we try to understand.
Exactly. But step into the world of economics or social structures and human history, and that x-ray machine suddenly just, well, it breaks down.
Completely.
We're looking at a diagnostic landscape that is incredibly murky. I mean, we want clean answers about how the world works, but as a new 29-page analytical report outlines, the diagnostic tools we have often come with a century of heavy, heavy baggage.
Yeah, and that baggage can make it nearly impossible to evaluate the original ideas objectively.
Totally. So today, we are taking you on a custom-tailored journey into that exact problem. The report we're looking at is titled Karl Marx: Life, Thought, Political Economy, Historical Theory, and Legacy.
Quite a title.
Yeah, prepared in August 2026 by the American newspaper and American TV. Now, if you are a curious learner, you know that Marx is almost always buried under a mountain of ideological myth.
Oh, absolutely. He
Yeah.
is arguably the most recognizable and, well, simultaneously the most misunderstood thinker of the last two centuries.
Right. So our mission today is to strip away those myths. We want to look at the actual 19th century texts he wrote to see how his work operates as a diagnostic tool for modern capitalism.
I love that approach.
But really quickly, before we begin, because this deep dive covers politically charged concepts, we want to make it absolutely clear to you, the listener, we are taking no sides here.
None at all.
We are not endorsing right-wing or left-wing viewpoints. Our goal is strictly to impartially unpack the factual content of this specific analytical report so you can understand the ideas contained in the original source material.
Just the facts, yeah.
Okay, let's unpack this. To really understand the theory, we first have to understand the man who lived it, right? Because his economic philosophy didn't just like drop out of the sky into a pristine academic journal.
Oh, far from it. Marx wasn't some ivory tower academic spinning abstract theories in a vacuum. His biography is entirely inseparable from the material he wrote.
Yeah, the report goes pretty deep into that.
It does. We actually have to start in 1818 in Trier, which is a city in the Prussian Rhineland. Marx was born into this long Jewish rabbinical lineage.
Oh, wow.
But his father, Heinrich, actually converted to Protestant Christianity.
Right, and I recall the report detailing that this wasn't some profound spiritual awakening either.
No, not at all.
His father converted due to Prussian legal restrictions that literally barred Jewish people from holding certain professional positions, like, practicing law.
Exactly. And that conversion gave a young Karl Marx a very early, very personal lesson in the mechanics of power.
Because he saw the hypocrisy.
Yes. He saw firsthand the massive gap between formal legal equality, what a state writes down on paper, and the actual lived social reality of exclusion based on identity and class.
So he carries that skepticism with him to the University of Jena, where he gets his doctorate in 1841. But intense state censorship against political radicals at the time meant getting a comfortable university job was just completely off the table.
Yeah, they locked him out. And that lockout forces him into journalism, specifically editing a paper called the Rheinische Zeitung in Cologne.
Which was a big deal.
Huge deal. This journalistic pivot is the crucible for his entire worldview. Instead of debating abstract philosophy with other academics, he is suddenly forced to report on real material crises.
Like actual problems.
Right. He's covering the extreme poverty of local peasants, heated debates over international free trade, and these severe new forestry laws.
Those forestry laws are such a perfect example of his shift. The state started severely punishing poor peasants just for gathering fallen wood in the forests,
Yeah, just picking up twigs.
something they had done for generations to survive. And all of this was just to protect the private property rights of wealthy landowners.
Witnessing the state use its legal apparatus to criminalize poverty for the benefit of landowners shattered his previous philosophical framework.
Right, because before that he was a Hegelian, wasn't he?
Yeah, up until that point, Marx had been heavily influenced by the philosopher Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. Hegel viewed history through a lens of dialectics.
Which is the clash of ideas.
Basically, it's the idea that progress happens when a dominant idea, a thesis, clashes with its opposite, an antithesis, and they eventually resolve into a new, higher state called a synthesis.
But Hegel was focused on the spirit of history. He thought human progress was driven by these grand abstract ideas crashing in the intellectual ether.
Exactly.
Marx looks at the starving peasants and realizes abstract ideas don't pay the rent or explain why kids are hungry. It's like an armchair philosopher being forced to work the night shift, you know? Suddenly, abstract ideas just don't cut it.
That's a great way to put it.
So how did he actually take Hegel's dialectic and flip it into something grounded?
Well, what's fascinating here is a concept Marx developed called praxis, which you see really clearly in his theses on Feuerbach.
Mm-hmm.
He essentially declares that philosophers have spent too much time just interpreting the world in various ways.
Right.
The actual point is to change it. He takes Hegel's mechanism of the dialectic, the clash of opposing forces, but strips away all the mystical idealist focus on spirit.
He pulls it down from the clouds and into the mud.
Precisely. Marx argues that it isn't a clash of ideas that drives history forward. It is a clash of material interests.
Like, how do people eat?
Exactly. How do people eat? Who owns the land? Who performs the physical labor? History progresses when opposing social classes clash over these earthly realities.
Material conditions run the world. Yet the report highlights a supreme irony here, which I find just fabulous.
Oh, the funding situation.
Yeah. The great defining critic of capitalism survived largely because of a capitalist. His lifelong collaborator, Friedrich Engels, funded the Marx household using the profits from his own family's textile mills in Manchester.
It is deeply ironic. And we shouldn't picture that funding as some luxurious arts grant either.
No, it was rough.
Very rough. When Marx was expelled from mainland Europe after the failed revolutions of 1848, he ended up in exile in London. The reality of his life there was tragic.
Yeah, the report mentions severe poverty, dodging creditors, chronic illnesses.
And the heartbreaking deaths of four of his seven children before they reached adulthood. It was grim.
Wow.
He spent his days in the British Museum reading room, obsessively studying factory reports and classical economics, while his family barely survived in the slums.
Just sitting in the heart of the British Empire's industrial boom, watching that immense wealth being generated while his own family suffered, it forces him to ask a mechanical question. If material reality, who eats, who works, is the foundation of everything, he had to open up the hood of the capitalist machine to see how it actually processed human labor.
And he was trying to solve a specific puzzle that had completely stumped the great classical economists who came before him.
People like Adam Smith.
People like Adam Smith and David Ricardo.
Yeah.
The puzzle was this. If you have a perfectly competitive market and everything exchanges at its fair market value, meaning nobody is getting scammed or robbed at the cash register, where does profit actually come from?
Right. How does money miraculously grow just by circulating?
Marx finds the answer by making a crucial distinction. The report emphasizes that this is the linchpin of his mature political economy. He realizes that workers do not sell the actual fruits of their labor to their boss.
Okay.
They sell their capacity to work what he calls their labor power for a set amount of time.
Ah, I see. So selling your labor power is like renting out a car to a company.
Okay, I like this.
They pay you a flat daily rate for the rental. But once they have the keys, they drive that car for 24 hours straight to squeeze out as many miles as physically possible.
Right.
The flat rate is the wage, and the extra miles driven are the profit.
That is a brilliant way to picture it.
Oh.
Let's look at the math of exploitation as Marx saw it, using a simplified example.
Sure.
Imagine a worker's daily wage is enough to buy their food, shelter, and basic survival needs. Let's say it takes 4 hours of average work to produce the equivalent value of that daily wage.
Okay, so 4 hours into the shift, the worker has essentially paid for themselves. They've generated enough value to cover the flat daily rental rate of their labor power.
But the worker's shift doesn't end at 4 hours. The shift is 8 or 10 or 12 hours long.
Wow, yeah.
Those extra hours of work generate what Marx calls surplus value for the employer. The employer bought the daily capacity of the asset, and the entire goal of the system is to run that asset past the break-even point.
The crucial takeaway for the listener here is that this dynamic is entirely structural. It requires zero active malice or greed or cartoonish evil by the boss.
Exactly. The boss pays the exact fair market rate for the worker's time.
The exploitation is just baked into the mathematical requirement of generating surplus value.
It is the invisible engine of the entire system.
But wait, I have to push back a little on the mechanics of this value creation.
Sure, go ahead.
Did Marx actually think all value just comes from a stopwatch measuring how long someone works? Like, if I'm terrible at my job and it takes me 10 hours to knit a sweater, is my sweater suddenly incredibly valuable just because it took me forever?
Well, this raises an important question, and it's a very common critique of his labor theory of value.
Right.
The answer is no. Marx explicitly measured what he called socially necessary labor time.
Socially necessary.
Yeah. That metric refers to the average time required to produce something under normal, prevailing industry conditions using the standard technology of the day.
So the market enforces an average.
Yes. If you use outdated, hand-cranked tools to make a sweater, and it takes you twice as long as the mechanized factory down the street, your sweater does not contain twice as much value.
Because you're just slow.
Exactly. Market competition forces prices toward that social average. If you are slow or inefficient, your extra labor time is essentially wasted value. You just lose out.
That focus on the social average leads perfectly into one of his most famous and maybe most confusing concepts, commodity fetishism.
Oh yeah, that term trips up a lot of people.
When I hear that phrase, I immediately picture consumers obsessing over a luxury brand or, you know, camping outside a store for the newest smartphone.
It sounds like a critique of consumerism, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But in Marx's framework, commodity fetishism refers to a structural illusion.
An illusion?
Yeah. In a capitalist system, the complex relationships between people, the miners, the factory workers, the logistics drivers, are disguised as objective relationships between things.
Okay, walk us through how that illusion actually works in practice.
Think about that smartphone you mentioned. When you see it sitting on a sleek wooden table in an Apple store, with a price tag of $999, it looks like a sterile, independent object.
Right, it's just a thing.
And the price tag feels like a natural fact, like the weather or gravity. But Marx is saying that behind that sterile price tag is a vast, hidden web of human social relations.
Meaning you're entirely separated from the people in the Democratic Republic of Congo mining the cobalt, or the workers in Shenzhen assembling the motherboards on 12-hour shifts.
Exactly. We fetishize the commodity by treating it as an independent object with its own mystical life.
Wow.
The market magically erases all the human sweat, the power dynamics, and the social structures that put the phone on the shelf, condensing it all into a single, sterile number.
Man, if the capitalist machine is this relentless engine squeezing out surplus value and erasing human suffering behind shiny price tags, you would assume Marx purely 100% hated it.
You really would.
But the report points out something that completely upends the usual narrative. He was arguably one of capitalism's biggest admirers.
This is where the caricature of Marx just falls apart. If you read the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels actually praise the bourgeoisie, the capitalist class, for being the most revolutionary dynamic force in human history.
This saw it as a massive, necessary upgrade over the stagnation of feudalism.
Capitalism violently broke down old aristocratic hierarchies. It tore apart local isolation.
Right.
It proved what human activity could actually accomplish by revolutionizing production, building immense infrastructure, and expanding the world market. Marx saw it as an unprecedented engine for technological innovation.
And here's where it gets really interesting for you, the listener, sitting in the 21st century. The report explicitly states that Marx's diagnostic framework has high explanatory power for the world we live in right now.
We can see his theories playing out in real time. Look at modern globalization, the relentless corporate drive to cross borders in search of cheaper inputs and cheaper labor. That is the exact mechanism of seeking higher surplus value that Marx described.
Or look at the modern gig economy. If Marx were alive today, he wouldn't be standing outside a soot-covered textile mill in Manchester. He would be studying big tech.
Absolutely.
He'd be analyzing how delivery apps and remote work software monitor our productivity down to the exact second. Algorithmic management is just a high-tech tool for controlling working time and maximizing that surplus value.
Hold on.
But if his diagnosis of the technological drive in the gig economy was so accurate, why didn't the whole system eventually collapse like he supposedly predicted it would?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, we have to look at the mechanism behind his prediction, which was the falling rate of profit.
Okay, what's that?
Marx argued that to compete, capitalists constantly replace human workers with faster, better machines.
Which makes sense. I mean, automation increases output.
But remember his core theory. Only human labor power generates new surplus value.
Right.
Machines just transfer their own value into the product. So as the proportion of human labor shrinks relative to machinery, the overall rate of profit in the economy tends to fall, which leads to increasingly severe economic crises.
So why didn't that tendency destroy the system?
Because it was a tendency, not a mechanical prophecy. And Marx underestimated several massive counteracting forces.
Like what?
For one, he didn't fully anticipate the creation of modern welfare states and the incredible power of labor unions in the 20th century.
How did the welfare states specifically stop the collapse?
By boosting consumption. When unions fought for and won higher wages, and governments instituted social safety nets, they essentially created a massive, comfortable middle class.
Ah, and they buy all the stuff.
Exactly. That middle class now had the disposable income to buy all the mass-produced goods the factories were churning out, which prevented the catastrophic underconsumption crises Marx envisioned.
Makes total sense.
Furthermore, his core framework assumed class identity would override everything else. He severely underestimated how powerful forces like race, gender, nationalism, and religion would be in mobilizing politics entirely independently of pure class struggle.
That massive gap, you know, between what Marx diagnosed in the 19th century and how the 20th century actually played out brings us to the elephant in the room.
We have to talk about it.
We have to talk about how an economic critique of Victorian England turned into the blueprint for 20th century authoritarian regimes.
Yeah, and the analytical report is very careful to separate the original texts from the later historical baggage. It explicitly warns against reverse engineering history.
Right.
You know, reading Leninism, Stalinism, or Maoism backward into Marx's original writing.
This is a huge distinction because when most people hear the name Marx, they immediately picture the Soviet Union or the People's Republic of China.
Right, the gulags and the secret police.
Exactly. But the report notes that Marx never actually wrote a detailed blueprint for a one-party state. He didn't write a manual for central planning or forced agricultural collectivization or a secret police force.
No, he didn't. In fact, when Marx looked at real-world political action, his views were surprisingly anti-authoritarian.
Really?
Yeah. He enthusiastically praised the Paris Commune of 1871 specifically because of its decentralized, heavily democratic nature and because it actively dismantled the old bureaucratic state apparatus.
But we have to address the terminology, though. What about the phrase dictatorship of the proletariat? I mean, to a modern ear, that sounds inherently totalitarian.
It does sound bad, but we have to understand how Marx defined the concept of the state. In Marx's theory, every state is essentially an instrument of class rule, a way for one class to dominate another.
Okay.
Therefore, a capitalist democracy, no matter how free it seems, is functionally a dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, because the wealthy class holds the ultimate political and economic power.
I see. So when he said dictatorship of the proletariat, he wasn't calling for a single dictator.
Not at all.
He was using the term to describe a transitional period where the power dynamic is simply flipped. The working class, the proletariat, would temporarily hold the political power to change the property laws.
Exactly. It was a description of class dominance, not a call for the totalitarian dictatorships we saw in the 20th century.
Wow, okay.
And speaking of property laws, the report highlights a major misconception check here. Marx did not want the state to take away your personal toothbrush.
Or your house, or your clothes.
Right.
Right. When he talked about abolishing bourgeois private property, he was talking about private control over the means of production.
The big stuff.
Yeah, the factories, the vast tracts of land, the digital infrastructure.
He was targeting class property that allows one group to extract labor and surplus value from another. He had absolutely no interest in your personal possessions.
To put his diagnostic tool in perspective, the report compares him beautifully to other foundational sociologists.
Oh, the tool analogy, yeah.
Yeah, if you want to understand how a bureaucracy operates or how status functions, you use the X-ray machine built by Max Weber. If you want to understand social cohesion, religion, and community solidarity, you use the tools built by Emile Durkheim.
Right.
Oh, if you want to understand ownership, class power, and the systemic, relentless drive for capital accumulation, Marx's diagnostic tool is completely unique.
Which brings us back to the question of authoritarianism. If Marx's tool was just a critique of capital accumulation, why were his ideas so easily adapted by later authoritarian figures?
Yeah, so what does this all mean? It sounds like blaming Marx for the Soviet Union is like blaming the guy who invented the combustion engine for a massive multi-car pileup on an interstate highway 100 years later.
That's a really good analogy.
The invention was adapted and driven in ways the inventor never foresaw, but why did that happen?
It happened because of the massive theoretical vacuum Marx left behind.
A vacuum?
Yes. he focused his entire life on critiquing the mechanics of capitalism, leaving his vision of a post-capitalist future incredibly underspecified. He provided almost no institutional details about how a socialist society would actually be administered on a daily basis.
So later revolutionaries essentially had an empty canvas they had to fill.
Exactly. Marx originally thought revolution would naturally occur in advanced, highly industrialized societies like Britain or Germany, where capitalism had already built the massive infrastructure needed to sustain a new system.
But that didn't happen.
No, it didn't. When that failed, 20th century revolutionaries found themselves trying to force socialism into existence in largely agrarian, peasant-based societies.
Which required entirely different machinery.
Lenin had to invent the concept of the Vanguard Party, a tight authoritarian political machine, to force a revolution in the backward Russian Empire.
And Mao in China.
Mao had to invent a completely new framework for peasant mobilization in rural China. They borrowed Marx's vocabulary to legitimize their movements, but they had to build their own distinct, highly authoritarian political structures to survive.
Man, that is fascinating. So, what does this all mean for you today? Bringing it all together, Marx isn't a prophet you have to blindly obey, nor is he a villain you have to outright dismiss.
No, he's neither.
According to the source material, his real value today is offering a critical lens that you can apply to your own life.
You can take his concepts and apply them directly to your own workplace or industry. Ask yourself, who actually owns the foundational assets here? Who controls the daily labor process?
Yeah.
Why is it that we have massive, unprecedented increases in technological productivity, AI, advanced robotics, instant global communication, and yet that abundance coexists with widespread job insecurity and rising inequality?
It really forces you to look beneath the sterile price tags and examine the actual structure. But before we wrap up, there is one final unexplored nugget from the source that really caught your eye, and it has to do with Marx's very last years.
Yes. I want to leave you with this thought to mull over. Toward the very end of his life, Marx was learning Russian specifically to study the traditional Russian rural commune.
Really? Russian?
Yes. And in his late letters, he actually suggested that human history didn't have to follow a rigid five-stage evolutionary ladder from feudalism to capitalism to socialism.
Wait, that completely breaks the stereotype of him as a rigid mechanical economic determinist.
It shatters it. He hinted that certain societies might be able to bypass the brutal stage of capitalist development entirely, building a new system directly from their existing communal roots.
Wow.
Furthermore, the source mentions a rapidly growing modern field known as eco-socialism. Scholars like Kohei Saito are currently digging through Marx's unfinished, unpublished notebooks on the natural sciences and ecology.
Okay, what are they finding in there?
They're exploring his concept of a metabolic rift. The idea that the capitalist drive for infinite accumulation creates an unsustainable, permanent break in the natural metabolism between human production and the Earth's ecosystems.
Oh, wow.
It begs a fascinating question for you to explore on your own. Could a dusty, unfinished 19th century manuscript actually hold the conceptual key to understanding and perhaps addressing our modern climate crisis?
Now that is a thought to chew on. So the next time you hear someone debating the economy, or you look at the price tag on a new smartphone, or you clock into an app that tracks your productivity down to the millisecond, remember the X-ray machine from the beginning of our deep dive.
Keep looking deeper.
The social world is murky, but if you strip away the historical baggage and the myths, you might just find a diagnostic tool that helps you see the bones of the system a little more clearly. Keep questioning the objective market forces around you. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.